Good morning. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to come here and speak to you and share some of the truth of God's Word. As I was talking to the Church of Kettering, I was telling about this preacher I was talking to. He said that he got a tape of his first sermon. In the background, he turned the volume, heard a thump, 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 thump. And he said it was this little microphone they put on his tie. But luckily I asked him and they weren't going to give me one of those, so you won't hear any thump, thump, thumps. So don't worry about that. One time a lady went up to a man who was a gospel preacher, and she pointed at him and says, "You're one of those Church of Christ people, aren't you? I think you're better than everyone else. You're the only ones going to heaven, aren't you?" Well, not many of us would say that openly. Sometimes we can feel that in our hearts, and we truly believe that we are better than everyone else, and that we're somehow special. So we have this hidden truth within us, and makes us better than everyone else. But is that what James is talking about, in James chapter 1, about this pure and undefiled religion? We think of the pure and undefiled religion as one that's, not marred by the world and is unstained by such thing as greed and envy. But, he actually says, undefiled religion before God is to visit orphans and widows in their afflictions and keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, what is this thing he's talking about, this visiting orphans and widows in their afflictions and keeping oneself unspotted from the world? Well, first off, he says, visit orphans and widows. But that's not really the same concept as it was back then. In the Jewish culture, orphans and widows were despised by society. They were cast out of the cities or put into debtors' prisons. They were put out with the lepers, where they would often die. Interesting. Today when politicians want to get into office, they go around and they give out big, large checks to orphans' homes. And they go around, they hold babies, and they shake people's hands. Those are noble deeds in our society. Those are good things. We get honor for those things. But that's not what James is talking about at all. When he says to visit orphans and widows in their affliction, he says, when they're at their lowest points, when they have nowhere else to go, you humble yourselves and you serve them to the best of your ability, and you never look back. And I think that's what he's talking about here is our lives as servitude, as being servants. Some great examples is Jesus, what he does. In Mark chapter 2, we have this really amazing scene that Mark records for us. Jesus has just met Levi and he called him to him. And Levi gets so excited because Jesus has called him. And so he gets really excited. Come to my house, we're going to have a feast. And so he prepares this large feast and he brings all these people to him. And I want you to take note on who's there. In verse 15, he talks about tax collectors and sinners being with Jesus. These aren't your high people in the Jewish society. They aren't the rabbis. They aren't the people at the synagogue. They aren't the Pharisees or even the Sadducees. These are the sinners. Of all people, you'd think, God himself would be reclining at a table with sinners. And this must be like an open scene or like maybe in a courtyard. It talks about how the Pharisees, they walk by and they can look in, they can see this. And they ask his disciples, why is he eating with tax collectors and sinners? And his response to them, later on, verse 17, it says, when Jesus heard it, he said to them, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick, I came not to call the righteous, but the sinners. And Jesus said this was his purpose in coming to earth, was to be a servant to sinners. He didn't come for the righteous because they don't need that. They're already righteous. But those who are sick, those who need a physician, that's exactly who he came for. Another example of Jesus is in John chapter 13. There we have Jesus washing the disciples' feet. It talks about how he gets up from the table, he sheds his outer garments, he girds himself with a towel, and he goes around washing his disciples' feet. And it's interesting, to think, God, and he has his disciples, his servants, people who he's going to later send out into the world, who he's going to command for his army, if you would, the army for the Lord. And here he is, he's bowing down before them, cleansing their feet. And starting in verse 12, it says, when he has washed their feet and put on his outer garments and returned to his place, he said to them, Do you not understand what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for I am so. If then your Lord and teacher have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should also do as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor a messenger greater than the one who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them. He's saying that I am the master, and you are the servant, and you are not greater than I am. And you know this. So if I'm able to humble myself and to serve you, then you need to humble yourselves and serve everyone else. These are the ones that were handpicked by God. My name isn't in the Bible. None of yours names are in the Bible. But these men, you know, to us, they seem special. You know, they're God's elect. You know, we talk about this, you know, all the Christians. But these are even a smaller group of even more elect Christians. They're apostles. And Jesus says, don't think highly of yourself. Humble yourself before one another as I, the Lord, have humbled myself before you. And we're starting to touch on what this true and pure religion is. He points out that, you know, they're servants. Our lives are a life of servitude. If it's not to our parents, to the government, but who better to serve than Jesus Christ himself, the Lord and Savior, the one who died for us. When serving him, we have to serve others. What about keeping oneself unspotted from the world or unstained from the world? Well, first off, we can put it this way, that one must be of the world, in the world, but not of the world. As Paul talks about in Romans chapter 12, verse 2 says, do not be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what is the will of God, that is good, acceptable, and perfect. He's saying that by your lives, you have to show what the will of God is. By not being conformed to the world, that's how we show what the true word of God is. Well, James kind of words it slightly differently. In James chapter 4 and verse 10, he talks about how we have to be enemies of the world. We don't usually use such strong language, but James does, and I think it's quite interesting. Starting in verse 4. You adulterous people, do you not know that friendship of the world is enmity with God? You adulterous people. What a strong rebuttal that is. To say that you're adulterous to God. You know, it's one thing to cheat on your spouse, but it's another thing to cheat on God Almighty. We think about the earthly concept of what happens, you know, the consequences of what will happen if you cheat on your spouse. It's pretty grave. A lot of bad things happen to them. A lot of families are split open. A lot of hearts are broken. But to be adulterous people to God, something far, far greater. He said, that is what you're doing when you are friends with the world. If you try to push that border towards the world and don't try to draw near to God, as it talks about later on in the verse. It talks about that in verse 8. It says, draw near to God and he will draw near to you. That's what's needed in our lives every day. John talks about this in yet another light. In 1 John chapter 2. Starting verse 15, he says, do not love the world, the things of the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the desire of the flesh, the desire of the eyes, and the pride of possession, is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, but whoever does the will of God abides forever. So many times we try to store up wealth for ourselves. We try to hoard everything. It's interesting that he says that the things of the world are going to pass away. There's an old story. Of course, it's just a story. Don't take it literal at all. But this man, he builds all this wealth up. And right before he dies, he decides he's going to transfer all the gold. Because, you know, gold's valuable everywhere. And what's American currency when he dies? So, but if he has gold, that's going to be worth something. So he gets to the gates of heaven. and he's carrying this gold and says, please let me bring this into heaven. I worked all my life for it. I want it so bad. And St. Peter goes, well, what's in the bag? And what's so special that you're going to beg me for? And what is heaven not going to offer? He goes, well, it's just this. And he opens the bag. And St. Peter looks inside. He goes, oh, good, you brought asphalt. He worked all of his life, and heaven is just lined with this stuff, and it's worth nothing. True possession, true prosperity is in God. So many times we forget about that, and we strive after other things. I think one of the biggest problems we have, at least for my generation, is that we hear all this time about love, love, love. You have to love everyone, you have to be accepting of everyone. But I'm here to tell you that we need to learn how to hate. I'm not talking about learning how to hate your brothers or sisters. I have a sister that's pretty annoying, but I still love her. Shouldn't hate her. We shouldn't learn how to hate each other, but we need to learn how to hate sin. To truly abhor sin as God abhors sin. And then you're starting to approach what true, pure, and undefiled religion is before God. But to do this, to have this pure and unstained religion, you must start off by being unstained. You know, when you go to work on your car, you put on your old garments, your old jeans that have rips in them, and they already have paint on them from painting the living room. They already have grease stains from the last time you changed your oil. So you put those on. And there's no point in trying to keep those clean because they're already dirty. But Colossians chapter 3 talks about this. Paul writes to the Colossian brothers, talks about how they have to have these clean garments. And it's interesting how he puts it. And starting in verse 5, he says, put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you, your sexual immorality, your impurity, your passion, your evil desire, and your covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these things, the wrath of God is coming. In these things you once walked when you were living in them. But now you must put them all away. Anger and wrath, malice, slander, obscene talking from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you have put off the old self. Let's get down to verse 12. It says, put on then, as God's chosen, holy and beloved, compassion, kindness, humility, meekness, patience, and bearing one another's burdens, giving one to another, forgive each other. And this is an amazing verse, because it says, you need to shed your old self. And talking, starting back in chapter 2, he talks about how we're supposed to be rooted in God. We're supposed to be built up and walk in God. All these great action verbs that are amazing. We're supposed to be doing all these things in Christ. He talks about in chapter 3, and, you know, starting in verse 2, he says, set your mind on things that are above and not on things that are earth. We are called out of what we once were into Christ. And that's amazing to think about that. We're supposed to put to death the things that are earthly within us. And put on God. I want to note something here in verse 12. Starting in verse 12. The Greeks didn't really have anything to make explanation points. They didn't have punctuation. They didn't have character. They didn't have paragraph markings. So if they want to emphasize stuff, they would put it in parallelism. And I want to draw out verses 12 and 13 for you, if I can spell correctly, which I'm not going to promise anything right now. But it says, put on, as God has chosen ones, holy and beloved, put on compassion. Put on patience. Put on humility. Put on meekness. You need to put on this is kindness, my bad.
You also need to put on bearing burdens.
No, my handwriting isn't anything great. But I want you to notice this. That he wants to compare compassion with bearing burdens. If you want to be compassionate, you need to bear one another's burdens, regardless. If you want to have kindness to one another, you have to be patient with one another. And if you want to have humility, you have to be meek. But something else to notice is that everything centers around the two center points right here. He says, you can't have kindness without humility, you can't have compassion without humility, you can't have patience without humility, and you can't bear one another's burdens without humility and meekness. Everything centers around this. I think this is us as Christians, this is one of our greatest needs, is that we need humility, we need meekness. He's saying that in this verse that if you want to put off the old man and put on the new man, you have to humble yourself to one another. Talk about that. John talks about that. Matthew talks about that. And Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, you know, they come to him and they said, what is the greatest commandment? And as a child, I always thought that was a very odd answer what Jesus gave. Is, well, love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind, and the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. And I'm thinking to myself, when I'm 7, he just gave 2 commandments. And they only asked him for 1, and he's God and he's infallible. Why is he giving 2 answers to 1 question? Well, the answer is, he's not. He's saying that the second one is like the first one. If you're going to have true love for God, you have to love one another. And that only comes through humility and meekness, as Paul's talking about in Colossians. And it really brings to life, and it really shows the verse in Colossians. And so that's what we need to do. To have this true and pure and undefiled religion, we have to submit to one another. We have to have compassion and kindness and humility and meekness. And we have to bear one another's burdens. We have to go to those who don't seem like they deserve it. You know, Jesus didn't go to the synagogues all the time. He did. But he also went where the sinners were eating. He also reclined at their tables. He also washed his disciples' feet who really, at this point in time, they really didn't understand very much of what was happening. Just kind of following along. But what about things that can mar your religion? Now we're going to focus right now on the book of James and see what James talks about this, because he's the one that we're really going to focus on right now, because he talks about this pure religion. It's kind of a theme that flows through the entire book. So we're going to kind of view some of these things. Well, starting off, in, you know, right there in verse 16, if anyone thinks his religion he is religious and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, his religion is worthless. His religion is vain. It's not worthwhile. So bridling your tongue is something that James talks about quite a bit. You know, starting in chapter 3, I mean, just going through the entire chapter 3, he talks about how this tongue is a small fire that can set ablaze an entire forest. You know, just think back, you know, maybe the past 10 or 15 years where you guys have been at this congregation, and think about people that this has happened to. That they haven't controlled their tongue, that they have slandered against one another. They haven't been patient, and they weren't kind. This is what he's talking about. That this little thing, our tongue, can be like the rudder of a ship that can sear our entire bodies and cause ruin to all. But how do we correct that? And how do we stop being so slanderous? Well, the obvious answer is, well, stop. And not only that, we have to build up one another. And that's part of the bearing one another's burdens and serving one another, is that we have to truly exhort one another. Not just to their face. Not say, well, you know, you did a really good job song leading. Tell others that you did a really good job song leading. You know, tell others about your brothers and sisters and how they're doing great. Each one of us has a true gift from God, I believe. Not maybe about the spiritual gifts that he talks about in, you know, Acts chapter 2 or in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. We have gifts that we can use. I'm not talking about the public service gifts, you know, like, you know, doing the Lord's table, song leading. I'm talking about, you know, being exhorters. You know, being uplifters. How about praying with one another? How about being understanding and forgiving? You know, these are true gifts from God. And we each have one. And we need to tell others about each other's. We may not to boast in our gifts, but to tell others about theirs. You know, how much more exhorting would that be to be like, so I went to church the other day, and I talked to so-and-so, you know, and we prayed after church, and he had the most amazing prayer that really uplifted me. Maybe he's a lousy song leader. Maybe he's just totally off key. You don't forget about that. It's not important. What's important is this gift that uplifts you and exhorts you. Also in James, talking about not bridling the tongue, chapter 4 and starting in verse 13, talks about the man, who wants to go into a foreign city, and he wants to make a business and, you know, buy and trade and make a profit. And so it says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow we will go into such and such a city and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your tomorrow will bring. And what is your life? For you are in the midst of what appears for a little while, but then it vanishes. He's not condemning the men right now of saying that they want to have a business. And he's not condemning them for wanting to move or even wanting to make money. He's condemning them for being haughty in themselves, the boasting about themselves. That's what he's condemning. It's not bridling their tongues and humbling their hearts. I think it's just interesting how he puts this, you know, that your life vanishes away like nothing. We think so often that we have so much time. And I'm more guilty probably than most of you, not but 20. You know, I have a whole another 60 years left as far as I'm concerned. But do I? He's saying that we need to submit ourselves to God. We need not to boast about ourselves because we have nothing to boast about. We can't decide when we die. What else does James mention that tomorrow religion and to make it a mockery? Well, starting in chapter 2, he talks about the man who shows partiality. You know, a rich man comes into the building and says, well, come sit here by the good seat. This is mine. And saying, well, come sit by me. You know? And the poor man, oh, you sit there at my footstool. And it seems like he's just talking about seating arrangements for the most part, where one sits in the building. Doesn't seem like a big deal. But, you know, start going on down a little bit, he likens this to murder. He likens it to adultery. It's amazing how he ties those together. You never, you know, think that maybe just a little bit of partiality would be murder. But that's what he says. Later on, he talks about how if you stumble on one part of the law, you're guilty of the entire law. And it's the same as if you are a murderer and adulterer by showing partiality. Pretty strong what he's saying here. Interesting, isn't it? Think that if we show partiality to one another, that's like we're killing one another. That we're guilty of the law, guilty of the blood of Christ. But what else? He talks about later on in chapter 2, talks about faith without works. So faith without works is dead. Once again, it will make your religion to be an open mockery to everyone, to show that you are hypocrites, to prove to everyone in the world that you really aren't truly religious. That if you do not work actively, think about Romans chapter 12, about the great hall of, Hebrews chapter 11, I'm totally wrong about that. Hebrews chapter 11, the great hall of fame of faith. You know, what is one of the common themes throughout the whole chapter is, you know, by faith Abraham believed. By faith Sarah conceived. By faith Abel offered. All action verbs. They all did something by faith. And by that, their faith was counted to them as righteousness. What about us today? Do we have this active faith? This faith that can produce righteousness, that can bring others to us. As Christians, we are to take, you know, a religion appealing. Not flashy and, you know, we're not going to put out a basketball court out there and we're not going to have, like, teen socials and potlucks in the basement. That's those ones we were talking about earlier, you know, in 1 John, talking about, you know, the pride. Things that appeal to the eye. What we're supposed to do as Christians is make our lives appealing. This is appealing to the world. To have a family that's compassionate. To have a family that can truly bear with your burdens. And that's one of the biggest things in our country now is not having good families. And that's exactly what we have. It's through this we have a good family. And that's attractive to the world. But if you aren't doing these things, if you aren't actively working, if you are showing partiality, and if you're not bridling your tongue, that makes your life unattractive. That makes you a hypocrite. And it's so horrible. James also talks about in chapter 4 and verse 1, you know, he says, "What causes quarrels within you and fights among you? Is not this that your passions are at war within you? You desire and you do not have, so you murder. You covet and cannot obtain, so you fight and you quarrel and you do not have, because you do not ask. And you ask, but you do not receive, because you ask wrongly and spend it on your own passions." Now, is he saying that any passion here is wrong? Any desire is wrong? I'll tell you one thing, I have a desire to eat, and I surely hope that one's not wrong. Because I wouldn't be around here for very long. He's not saying that. He's talking about your selfish desires. Desires that cause contentions, that cause rifts in the congregation, that can rip people apart. It flows right in with humility and the idea of bearing burdens and showing compassion. Is that you're going to give up those passions for others. That you're going to commit to others and help them out as much as possible because you love them. Well, what about riches? It's always a touchy subject in today's society, especially in America. We are the richest nation in the world. You know, by the age of 17, I thought it was a travesty that I didn't have a car. By the age of 18, I thought it was a travesty that I didn't have a car. And then I thought it was a travesty that I had a car with 230,000 miles on it. And these things are travesties because I don't have these physical possessions. And we get so tied up in everything that we have. But what does James talk about in chapter 5, starting verse 6? "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver have corroded and your corrosion will be evident against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have laid up treasures in your last days. Behold, the wages of your laborers who are mowing your fields, which you have kept back, are crying out against you, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You have lived in the earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the righteous person. He does not resist you." That's pretty strong. "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries." Interesting. Now, is he automatically talking about all people who are rich? And are we all going to go to hell because we have earthly possessions? That's not what he's talking about at all in this verse. He's talking about those who are rich and they hoard more money to themselves in their coffers, and they aren't sharing with one another. And it's interesting that Jesus talks about this in Matthew chapter 23, how it'd be easier for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through the eye of a needle. What about the rich young ruler that came to Jesus? He says, "What do I need to do?" And well, Jesus says, "You know the law." He says, "Well, I have done all these things. You know, I have loved my neighbor as myself. I have tithed all the time. I do all these things." And Jesus' answer is not, "Well, you're wrong. You're lying to me." His answer is, well, if you say so, then go take what you have and sell it and give it to the poor. He's not saying that, you know, we just need to go and sell everything we have. He's saying that he was proving that the man did not love his neighbor as himself, because he hoarded his wealth. He's saying that if you truly love your neighbor, then give freely to everyone. Give freely to your neighbor. I mean, these are some things that can truly mar your religion, that James talks about. You know, religion that is pure and undefiled is service to one another. It's submitting yourselves and giving yourselves to one another. To be spent, as Paul talks about. We need to be in the world, but not of the world. Our lives need to be something that the world can see as different, something as special, something appealing. But there are many things that can truly mar our religion, but not bridling your tongue, by being covetous, by acting upon your own passions that are greedy, by showing partiality to one another. So oftentimes we think that we have so much time in the world, that we have time for everything. Because we're busy right now, but later on we'll have time. And it's interesting how we think about this. Think about, you know, we're in middle school. Why do you have time to take it? It's always taken for us. You know, we never take it back. We're in middle school, you know. Things are busy right now. We're starting sports. You know, we're trying to have like a social life. Too busy right now for God. Maybe a little later. Some other time. Maybe we're in high school. Lunch is coming around. We want a car. We get a job. You know, we're working all the time. Going to school all the time, doing homework. Still playing sports. Too busy right now. Maybe a little later. Maybe in college. Finally graduated from high school. We have fairly good marks. We go to a pretty good college. Pretty soon. We have a boyfriend or girlfriend. And those eat up all your time. Still have a job, you have to pay for college, and still the car payments. Cell phone payments. Can't give up a job. We need a car to put a job. We need a boyfriend or girlfriend for happiness. God will come later. Well, get out of college. We're gonna try to get on our feet real quick so we get a good job. Work all the time. We need to save up because, you know, pretty soon you're gonna marry that boy or girl. You make money. So you're working. God will come later. Well, pretty soon you get married. For too long, there's kids. We all know those things come all the time. God will come later. Pretty soon the kids will be more active. And you're really wondering when God's going to come. And when can you put God into your schedule? But I'll come later. We got 20 more years. Kids grow up. They go to college. Finally, the kids are out of the house. We don't have to drive them everywhere. They're in their hair. Now you got to pay for college. Can I keep on working? God will come later. Maybe when you, before you know it, you don't have time. And we aren't promised that we're going to go, we're not promised we're going to have our retirement. We're not promised we're going to make it through high school or we're going to make it through college. But we are promised that God will come and keep the night. And His greatness will, and that His coming will bring doom upon those who have not served Him. The point is that we do not have time as we think we have time. Because we need to decide today if we're going to serve God. As I point out in Colossians, that revolves around humility. That you're going to truly commit yourself to God, that you realize that our lives are served to Him. But this is the time that the elders have set aside that if this is what you would like to do, if you'd like to submit yourself to God and do His service, please come forward as we stand to sing.